folks, welcome back to Surprise Mechanics, the only podcast about video games. I'm your co-host, Rumby Tell, and joining me, as always, live in studio, Kayla Jones. Greetings, gamer, I see you.
Greetings, gamer, I see you.
Don't look at me.
You're looking at me.
Don't look at me.
You're looking at
me. Stare at the Mikayla stares back. We're doing it in person again. It was fun last time.
It was very fun, yeah.
So we're doing it again. And this time, we're talking, it's kind of just a hodgepodge
yes.
of things we're talking about today. Because you played...
I played Fallout 1 and 2, the original Fallouts, mm-hmm. and you might guess that this was because I recently watched the Fallout TV show, which we talked about at the end of the last episode.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely because of that.
Yeah. And I played God of War Ragnarok Valhalla. So I'm kind of thinking maybe I should just go first, get this shit out of the way, because then when you talk about Fallout, I think there's stuff there we can both talk about. But I know you haven't played Ragnarok. Do you care that much about spoilers?
No, not that much.
Okay. I'm not going to do like a recap or anything. Just.
I figure I may someday play the game, and by that time, I will probably forget.
Great. Love that. Valhalla was a DLC they released at the end of last year mm-hmm. for Ragnarok. And I was a little surprised to see just how narrative it was. Because it is truly an epilogue to the story of the game. But basically, how it was explained to me, and I feel like the elevator pitch of God of War Ragnarok Valhalla is that it's a roguelike mode for God of War. And so I'll be honest, I went into it with just a little bit of skepticism. I heard good things, but I feel like, you know, the roguelike trend is so big right now. I feel like everyone's trying to get in on it. And it's one of those things where you're like, okay, but is it good though? Mm-hmm. Does this actually work as a roguelike? And I'm happy to say it absolutely does. Because the thing about Ragnarok, I've talked about it on the show. I liked the game quite a lot, but I did have some gripes, minor gripes. But they were all with the writing and the story. Mechanically, I have no complaints with Ragnarok. So Valhalla is basically just mechanics forward. There is a story, but being a roguelike, it's all about combat in that loop. So it rocks. Like, it's so good. I had such a blast playing this thing. By the end of the game, you actually have three different potential weapon loadouts you can use. And so basically each run of Valhalla, that's how the loop starts. The loop starts, you get the same starting two rooms, but you basically are going to choose which of the three weapons is going to be your main for this run. And there are incentives of trying to change out your run, use different items, use different attacks, because the sort of meta progression loop is all about completing tasks and earning currency that can make you stronger permanently for the next run. The combat in this felt deeper to me somehow.
Does it kind of force you to try all the things that you didn't do during the main story?
Exactly, yes. And at least for me, like, I felt the urge on my own to be like, I want to try to get at least to the end with each weapon at least once.
Mm-hmm. You know? You could become a true God of War.
I really, you know, and it's funny you say that, because narratively, what's going on in this game is Kratos and Mimir mostly Kratos, but by extension, Mimir, were invited to Valhalla. And you don't know by who. You find out who, because the person that invited you is the final boss of every run. But what's really cool about it is...
It's Santa Claus, isn't it?
It's Santa Claus, yes. It is Tim Allen. What's cool about it, though, especially in the context of Kratos and this franchise, is it was a friendly invite. It really is someone trying to help you. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of the boss fight, every time the person just goes, I yield. And then you like help them up. And there's like, they do the cool hard style shit. Yeah. And it's really cool because the guy who does it is a literal giant. So he like dwarfs Kratos. So Kratos is looking up at this guy, just being a little guy. These last two games, and you can speak to this as well because you've played 2018. You know, it's a lot about kind of Kratos confronting his past and moving forward and accepting that I did what I did. I'm not going to excuse it, but I'm going to accept it and move on and be better. What's going on in this game is Kratos is tackling the same thing, but his big struggle is he has been asked to be the new God of War in the Norse pantheon. And he is like, you don't know what you're asking me. Because the last time I had that throne, I did like unspeakably evil things. Mm-hmm. And it's all about him just being like recognizing he's a changed man. He is not the younger version of himself who was perhaps short-sighted and foolish. So much so that I'm sure they'll do a third one of these because it's God of War, right? But it's going to be very interesting because this feels really important to the next piece of the puzzle.
Right. Like this is a thing that you should probably play for narrative points.
Yes. And that surprised me. I did not expect that because I thought it was just going to be a roguelike, you know, mini game type thing.
Right. God of War is not slowing down anytime soon. Sony's probably like, oh, heck yeah.
Yeah. And I'm okay with it. Like this, they've really got me on board with this current, like, I guess, iteration of the franchise. And to your point, too, one thing Ragnarok does that's a lot of fun and they expand upon it in Valhalla is they kind of imply, and by kind of imply, I mean outright state, that other pantheons also exist. Mm-hmm. There's the Egyptian pantheon. There's the Aztec gods, like all those. And
so all the gods can get together for like a worldwide global god barbecue and exactly. Like just have feuds and
let's settle it. Let's squash the beef.
Get real upset with each other.
Well, you've heard the joke is that the next one is going to be Kratos starting some shit with Christianity. That's where they're going.
Kratos versus Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Actually, one thing I loved about this is every time you get to the final boss in Valhalla and you beat him, the next time you fight him, he uses a different weapon. So he's got a totally different moveset. And like one of them is like an Aztec club. Mm-hmm. One of them is like a katana. Cool.
It does incentivize you to replay both with trying new weapons and having like different enemies, like different things to account for, not just playing the same boss fight over. That's nice.
Yeah. And even after I beat it, I hit credits. I got all the trophies because it's not that hard to do. Mm-hmm. I did a couple extra runs just because I was having a great time.
Yeah.
Like I wasn't ready to be done yet.
It was a nice little fun DLC that doesn't outstay its welcome.
Yes.
That's good.
And I really can't believe it was free. I legitimately can't believe because there's like new cutscenes. Mm-hmm. They recorded a lot of new dialogue with Christopher Judge and the guy who plays Mimir. Don't remember his name.
Mimir, a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit Mimir. And content wise, there's new enemies. Mm-hmm. They actually bring back characters from old God of War games. Like there's like a lot going on here. And one thing I kept thinking about and originally I had planned to talk about this game for a while. And originally we were going to talk about it with The Last of Us 2's No Return mode and maybe some other roguelites. And I already talked about No Return in our episode of Last of Us Part 2 Remastered, but that was the roguelike mode they put with that game. Mm-hmm. And I just can't help but think about how both of these games went about this experiment in totally different ways. And each, in my opinion, had very different results. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, The Last of Us 2... In my opinion, I think the No Return mode kind of flounders a little bit. It is pretty fun, but it has no narrative component, which is kind of surprising for Naughty Dog, whereas Valhalla has
something
entirely narrative component, really. Yeah. Like it's because even when you're not, you know, engaging in new story content, Kratos and Mimir are always chatting and they're always talking about something new and you're not seeing the same dialogue again. And, you know, No Return was kind of hidden behind a paywall, really. I mean, it was I paid $10 for the upgrade, which I still don't feel bad about, but you have to buy that new version of Last of Us to play it.
Right. You can't play it on retro versions or like previous gen.
Yeah. This was completely free. If you own God of War, you get Ragnarok. Mm-hmm. Or I'm sorry, Valhalla, whatever.
I imagine
title is too long.
God of War,
Ragnarok,
Valhalla,
Mimir's Journey.
Roguelike. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of this, like, the big difference here, I think, is with having story and not having story. Like, that's kind of a nice change of pace. Is there a lot more to what you wanted to share about Valhalla?
No, just that I really, the final conversation I wanted to have was just comparing it a little bit to The Last of Us 2 mode and how I think it's very interesting. Naughty Dog attempted to make like an arcade style, which is valid, but it's not Risk of Rain 2.
Right.
You know, and not that it's fair to compare every type of game. Mm-hmm. To each other, but I feel like if I want an arcade roguelike, I'm gonna just Risk of Rain is king.
Yes.
I'm just gonna keep playing Risk of Rain.
That's a very hard game to put down.
Yes, whereas I was very pleasantly surprised at how unique Valhalla felt and how fun it felt and how much it really gripped me. I don't know if it counts as a game of the year contender because it wasn't a full game, but mm-hmm. if it does, it's on my list for sure. Because it's like this, so far we're almost halfway through the year now. I've had the most fun. One of the most fun gaming experiences I've had has been with this.
Gotcha. Okay. I think it's really interesting, too, like you said, how two different studios within Sony, Naughty Dog and Santa Monica, did this like approach to a roguelike. And they came out with two like wildly different conclusions.
Yeah.
Which is kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
To look at like how those like creative decisions will be different.
Right. The Last of Us 2 one feels a little lower effort. I don't know if that's fair to say, because it was fun and I did have a good time with it. And there was surely effort put into it and design put into it. But Valhalla is just so big.
Mm-hmm.
And I, after playing it, I would not have faulted them for charging for it. But I do think at the same time, I don't know if people would have played it.
Yeah, you probably would have had a fewer people playing.
Because there are so many roguelikes.
Right.
Like, there's so many of them now. So, I mean, just for myself, I probably wouldn't have purchased it.
Well, if about, like, 10 years ago, it would have been a Battle Royale. Because that's...
Part of me wanted to be like, not 10, but, I mean, fuck, yeah. Close to 10 years ago.
But, yeah, like, everything was Battle Royales. Now it's, like, roguelikes. We're going through a couple different, like... fad shifts, I think.
Oh yeah.
And like, just to think about a few years ago, Valhalla could have been like another battle royale.
Right. Kratos and is he in God of War?
He is in God of War, of course.
Of course you know him from God of War.
But more so you might Fortnite. Know him from Fortnite.
The dance.
I think he is in
His
Fortnite.
Dance is called The Boy.
The Boy.
You had me thinking about it'll come back to me. Give me 1 second. I'm entering my mind phallus.
Roman's doing this thing with his hands on his temple.
I'm entering the mind phallus. Fuck.
I see numbers floating in air in front of me.
It might be gone.
Equations, mathematics.
What were we talking about even?
We were talking about Battle Royale.
Fortnite. God of War.
Kratos dance.
I know it's gone forever.
Well, I did want to ask you something because earlier I mentioned Sony and it reminded me of some recent news. And would you want to talk about a little bit about
Helldivers? Are you asking 2? If I want to talk about Helldivers? Yeah, I want to talk about Helldivers 2 always. I'm bursting at the seams.
So I have not purchased Helldivers 2 yet. And recently I almost did. It's itching there. It's waiting for me to pull the trigger and jump in. And there's just so many games on this backlog that I'm like a little scared to do it because I might get sucked into Helldivers 2 and then my backlog is going to be neglected and it's just going to get bigger. And so I haven't bought it yet, but recently I had a good reason besides insecure fear. And that is that Sony pushed this policy change. It seems the story goes that when you bought Helldivers 2 on PC, you didn't need to set up a PlayStation Network account to play it.
'Cause why would you?
Yeah, you're on Steam, you're on PC, like you don't really need to sign into PlayStation Online. Like you're not on a PlayStation device. So a lot of people just kind of skipped that step. And recently Sony announced that they would require every player, regardless of platform, to create and sign in on a PlayStation Network account in order to play Helldivers 2. And realistically, this doesn't affect you or me at all.
No.
You're playing on PlayStation to begin with. And me, if I was playing on PC, I already have a PlayStation Network account because I have a PS4. And so this issue never really affected us. But it's the fact that it affected other people who have spent money on the game that really like irked me. And that's essentially what happened is PlayStation Network isn't like so ubiquitous that it's available in every country. And so people in countries that do not have PlayStation Network support, people were able to buy Helldivers mm-hmm. 2 and play it on PC through Steam until Sony mandated that network account.
Yeah, because it was going to go into effect in June. You would not be able to play the game.
Yeah.
Also, Sony gets hacked like every 6 months.
Yes.
So I super don't blame anyone for not wanting to like jump into that.
It is like a meme at this point with how often Sony gets hacked. And I remember like 2012, one of the first big ones.
Yeah.
The PlayStation 3
era. Did you get a free game? What'd you get?
I don't remember.
Did you pick Infamous?
Maybe.
Yeah, I got my PS3 like right after that. Like literally, I was not eligible.
I might have missed it.
But I picked up Infamous for like $10 at Best Buy.
Yeah, I might have missed the window for that because since the PlayStation 3 and onward, I have been really like late to the game with consoles in general. So like it's what, 2024 and I still don't have a PS5, you know?
Save it for the Switch too.
Yeah, who knows if I'll ever get a PS5.
Yeah.
But it just really sucks that with this game that so many people were able to play and enjoy together, that they paid for full price, yeah, they would just have that ripped out from underneath them. And like, sure, maybe Sony would have acquiesced and given out like mass refunds, but it just goes to show that like suits and executives at these corporations have no fucking clue what they're doing when they're like, all right, we're gonna mandate this so that our engagement numbers with this particular thing goes up, and then everybody pushes back against it, rightfully, because it kind of, you know, fucks everything up for everybody in some respect. And it was a nice thing to wake up, was it yesterday, mm-hmm, I think, and see that, oh, Sony like gave up.
Yeah,
like,
they reversed
course and decided to allow Helldivers 2 to go and be successful instead of like killing their own like new hit themselves.
Right. I actually do. I will. I kind of got to give it to the CEO of Arrowhead, the developer. He's actually been pretty communicative and open about the whole thing and about everything with the game in general. We'll never know all the details because, like, it's one of those things where it's like, well, how long did they know this was going to happen?
What contract is it in? Yeah. When did they sign?
Exactly. So I don't necessarily believe everything everyone is telling me about it. I don't even believe the official reasoning they were given as to why they were going to do it. It sounds foolish to me. But I think, I forget the guy's name, but the CEO of Arrowhead has actually done a pretty good job of being very diplomatic, like not outright saying it's Sony, fuck Sony.
Right.
But he's kind of like, it's out of my hands, that kind of thing.
He's been pretty, I've seen some of the tweets from Arrowhead employees and like, it's been pretty like forthright and honest.
Yeah.
And to the degree that it kind of even sense a little bit of like desperation and like, maybe not desperation, but like you just kind of feel this like sadness from the CEO. Because I saw this one tweet where someone asked, like, I live in this country that doesn't get PSN. How am I supposed to play the game that I paid for? And he just replied with like, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I get that. Like at some point, like you just don't know. And it's really nice to see someone being human rather than using like a copy and pasted corporate legal written like script. Because you go anywhere on social media, you go anywhere to try to like communicate with a big corporation that you've like given money to. So you have like some skin in the game for wanting to keep the product that you bought. And like, it's not just like, okay, we're going to stonewall you with corporate speak.
Yeah. And even kind of even broader, how come everyone has to pretend every little piece of a puzzle is that, when instead it's not just actually a thing that happened.
Right.
Like, for example, like you're saying, I appreciate that guy's just like, I don't know. Like, I don't know what to tell you because I don't know the answer to that. And it feels like a lot of times that's not an acceptable response. Mm-hmm. People are either supposed to just say some bullshit or be really coy about it for no reason. A more recent and not nearly as like serious of an example was actually with Spider-Man 2 last year. I talked to Caleb about this a lot. There was people noticed, myself included, obviously, that the sign of Nelson and Murdoch in Hell's Kitchen was just blank. Mm-hmm. And it looked like there was an evicted thing on the door. So people thought it was maybe like a little bit of world building, you know, like, oh, Nelson and Murdoch is no more. Like, what's up with that? And people actually asked one of the lead devs, maybe even like, I don't know, someone really high up at Insomniac. And he was like, oh, that is interesting. Stay tuned. That was the official reason he gave. And then what happened was they patched it and fixed it, so the sign worked. But I'm like, why be so weird and coy about it? Right. Why be like, I don't know.
Something like, big is coming in the future. Just,
yeah, and maybe he didn't know. Maybe he legitimately thought, oh shit, are we doing something Daredevil? I don't know. But why not even just be like, you know, I'm actually not sure. I have to look that up.
Yeah.
Can I give a real world example of when this happened to me?
I'm sure if you want to.
I was working as a bellboy at a certain major vacation destination in Orlando, Florida, and I was asked about the bus schedule, and I said, I remember exactly, I said, I don't know, but let me check for you. And I turned and I started to grab like the literature we had to figure. Don't look at me. I know I said it weird. Don't look at me like literature.
Literature.
Shut up. And one of my managers just happened to be there and he answered the question. And then the woman left and I turned to him and said, oh, thanks for that. And he was like, very seriously looked at me and said, remember, it's unacceptable to say you don't know an answer, especially when it's something you should know, like bus schedules. And I'm like, oh, so I should have just lied to her? Said something? It's not like I said, I don't know, buzz off. It was like, I don't know, let's figure it out together.
Yeah, yeah. Your bus will arrive in approximately 3 years.
Oh, doing a full Charles Xavier thing. Oh. Like, yeah, that was weird.
You're not allowed to not know anything, and you're also not allowed to know anything.
Exactly.
And of course, yeah, you're getting paid, what, like $15 an hour? Maybe
not 10, even. Are you kidding me?
$10 an hour.
This was also like 2013.
Yeah. So it was 10 years ago. So $15 an hour was a pipe dream back then.
Yeah.
I mean, in some cases still is today.
Some places, yeah.
But yeah, that's fascinating. And I think, okay, so back to Helldivers, not only from some of the devs, I've seen like some decent interactions. One of the community managers on their forum responded to upset players, telling them, hey, go like review the game, like voice your opinion. And immediately overnight, the Steam reviews tanked.
Yeah, and I honestly think that's the thing that made it. And Valve said they would give people refunds.
Right.
And there's no way they eat that cost. They pass it on to Sony. So I think that's ultimately, I think Valve maybe saved it.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a combination of the threat of mass refunds, because like there's got to be a substantial population outside of PSN supported countries that wants to play this and has played this game, purchased it. And
even if they could play it, I would still argue, like, if you have been playing a game for several months and now all of a sudden the game requires you to make this new external account, it's totally your right to be like, no, give my money back.
Right.
This was not the agreement we made when I bought the game.
Exactly. And I mean, the state of games these days as well is this like agreement that is not even a factor of you owning a game. Like even like buying a game on disc these days, it's technically like a license to play it. You don't own something.
Yes. Yeah.
And so that on its own kind of sucks, because then you have platforms like Steam and Epic Games and PlayStation, and you can have games just kind of ripped out from underneath you that you paid for, you know?
Yeah.
Or who knows what things like this happen, and then suddenly, you know, you spent $50 on a game, you can't play anymore, you're out $50.
Yeah.
You deserve that refund.
Absolutely.
And if you do get it, like, fuck, Sony like held my money for however many months. I should get interest. Jeez.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But I do think it's very funny that Sony did this. It seems like it could have been in the works before. I saw some admission from the CEO that was like, yeah, we knew. And they kind of accepted some level of blame and fault.
I read that he said we knew 6 months before launch, I think.
Right. And so with that, it's kind of hard to say if it was like a gut decision some executive made or if it was like in a contract somewhere that they signed.
It was not in the cup. Not to like,
that's
what I'm saying. I don't know if I believe any, like,
it's hard to tell. Yeah. It's really hard to like pinpoint precise facts in this type of thing, because like, unless you're part of Arrowhead and you're privy to the kind of like business contracts they're dealing with publishers, then you're not going to know precisely. The only thing you can be happy for is that like Sony decided not to like stick with a dumb decision,
right?
Which they seem to kind of struggle with a lot.
Like, yeah, it's Sony. They can't help. I'm a Sony pony. You know, I'm a PlayStation guy, but they can't help themselves, can they? They sure do like to step on rakes.
They certainly can't. And to the degree that like I want them to start releasing some of these damn games on PC.
Yeah. One final thing I will give the CEO of Arrowhead credit for as well is he did say it was ultimately his call to not tell people. And that is, again, if that is true, that is a pretty brave thing to admit. Mm-hmm. But also, if it's not true, that is one hell of a grenade to throw yourself on top of.
Yes, that for sure.
It's either way, it's like, hey, you know, I think they handled it as well as it could be handled. I heard some people were mad at some community managers, but I mean, whatever. I don't know. I don't follow it close enough, and I don't care to go through that fine-tooth comb. Long story short, Kayla's buying Helldivers.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, it depends on the Fallout.
You mean how many more Fallout games you have to play? Oh, yeah, you just said you got into 76. How's that going?
I haven't played 76.
You were going to?
Maybe.
Yeah, why not?
I've considered
it. Why not try it? I heard it's okay now.
I've heard it's gotten better, but I'm still a little skeptical.
Yeah.
When all of the Fallout games were on sale on Steam, I did not buy it, but I did fill the gap of not having Fallout 3 in my library, and I'm currently playing through Fallout 3. No,
first one I played.
Same here.
Yeah.
Same here.
Right? I guess, we were about the age.
Fallout 3 in 2008. Yeah. Speaking of Fallout, I think it's time for Fallout.
Let's do it.
Okay, so the Fallout TV show is cool. We talked about that plenty. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely given me the spark, as everybody predicted, that I would immediately become obsessed with Fallout and go and play some of the Fallout games, which I predictably have done. However, I started with two games in the series that I have not played before. And for some people are kind of hard to acquire because it's PC exclusive, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. So I played through Fallout 1 and Fallout 2. And these games were, in short, fantastic. A lot of the stuff from like Fallout 3, New Vegas, Fallout 4, newer, modern Bethesda Fallout, it's there in some respect, and you can see where Bethesda kind of they definitely like combed through these games to build theirs. Mm-hmm. So it was really fun going through this kind of like reverse referential like thing where playing Fallout 1 and 2, I'm like, oh, hey, I remember like this thing from Fallout 3 or Fallout New Vegas. And it's here in Fallout 1 and 2. That's where it came from. Neat.
Yeah, sure.
Every game has had like the bloody mess perk, for instance, like where all of your enemies that you kill explode into giblets.
Yeah.
That's a tried and true series staple. So there's a lot of stuff about Fallout 1 and 2 that are very familiar, despite the fact that they're CRPGs. They have like a 2.5D isometric view, and they're turn-based entirely. They're very different games visually on the surface. I mean, one was released, I think, in the late 90s. Another one came out in like 2008, 2010. So like big difference in graphics there for sure.
Yeah, sure.
But that said, like the visuals of Fallout 1 and 2, both games look very similar. They came out like, I think, within a year of each other. They still look good, like from like a retro perspective. Mm-hmm. I'm someone who does like really enjoy like retro graphics and art styles. So like playing an older game with like really bad graphics is not like a deterrent to me at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been playing the Resident Evil classic games for how long?
Right.
So it looks good. It still looks good today to me. It takes a little bit of work to get running on a modern computer. If you want to have like all the amenities and, sure. and like you don't want to have to like click to open a door every single time you pass through a doorway. Mm-hmm. The actual gameplay of this game is familiar, not the same, but very familiar to the newer Fallouts. Like, one of the things I noticed about it was how quests are essentially somewhat like the same. You end up like finding settlements. People have problems that they want you to solve. And then there are oftentimes multiple groups that are fighting each other or vying for power within like their particular settlement. Then you have to kind of choose a side. And there's usually like a good group and a bad group, or it's a little bit more ambiguous. Not necessarily everybody is good, not necessarily everybody is bad. But at the end of the day, you're kind of deciding which group is going to rise up and like take power in this region, in this settlement, and whether or not like that prospers. Mm-hmm. And of course, like canon's kind of different. Like everybody knows Shady Sands from the very first game. It's like the first thing you encounter after leaving Vault 13, and how it becomes like the capital of the NCR. It grows to like massive proportion and then gets nuked in the fucking show.
Yeah.
It is cool seeing like kind of where the West Coast started out after people started leaving the vaults, and it's really expansive. Like the maps for these games are huge, but there's not a lot of like interactiveness in the map the way that you play mm-hmm. modern Fallout games. It's kind of like a two dimensional thing, where one dimension is the world map and another one is like the locations that you go to. The ghost dimension. Yeah. The locations you go to.
Phantom's in there.
Yeah.
Doing his thing.
So it's Casper the ghost.
Ghost police brutality.
Casper the friendly ghost is there too. Yeah. Just trying to help him out. Just trying to, you know, be a shoulder he can cry on.
Is that real?
What? Casper the friendly ghost?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is he really there?
Yeah, he's really there.
Did that really happen?
Yeah, he's there as a shoulder for Danny Phantom to cry
That's
on.
That's fucking crazy.
Whenever Danny Phantom is going through like hardship and needs like a guiding light, Casper the friendly ghost is his guiding light.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had no idea him and Casper.
It's the lore. It's canon. So,
you watch Vanderpump Rules yet?
No.
Do you watch the new season?
No.
It's a turd. It's a turd. It's bad.
You've mentioned that.
Yeah. We'll talk about it more in our Game of the Year episode.
So, of course we will. Because what Game of the Year episode have we done that hasn't had Vanderpump Rules mentioned?
I think most of them.
Okay, so there are two different types of stages. One is the world map. One is like the settlements and the places that you go to. And so when you're traveling around the world in Fallout 1 and 2, you have this like overworld map where you click your destination and your character starts traveling there. In a lot of cases, it can take several weeks to reach one settlement from another. And the original Fallout 1 gives you like 100 days to find a water chip for Vault 13 so that they don't run out of water and die. 100 days is a couple months. So traveling around the wasteland, it's going to take you a couple months to find that water chip. Thankfully, 100 days is a pretty lenient requirement, and you can extend it by sending merchants that sell water to Vault 13 to give them new supply of water. But that also opens them up to being known by the outside world.
Oh, that's interesting.
And there's a super mutant faction that is growing an army. And after you find the water chip, you essentially get a second quest, main quest, that is like find the mutants and destroy them. Because the super mutants are trying to take over the entire wasteland. So essentially the plot there is that this guy who became a super mutant computer after falling into a vat of FEV virus, forced evolutionary virus, he has this grand plan to like to mutate the entire population in order to like perfect humanity or whatever. And you're supposed to destroy him. You can kill him. You can convince him to kill himself. Or you can just blow up the nuclear reactor in the vault that he resides in. And then you have to go to a military base and, like, destroy all the vats of FEV.
How do you convince him to kill himself?
There is information you can learn from the Brotherhood of Steel who have been, like, doing autopsies on super mutants that they find. And the discovery by the Brotherhood of Steel is that all of the super mutants are sterile. Ooh. So, in effect, turning everybody into super mutants means that you're going to sterilize the entire world population and effectively end it in a single generation. And at that point, the master's like, oh, I fucked up real bad, didn't I? And then he sets off the self-destruct and tells you, like, you should leave now before you go boom. This game really emphasizes dialogue options, like the more intelligence and like speech you have. You do have like more things to say within certain skills. Like there are dialogue options that just won't show up, like kind of like in the new games, where if you have like science or doctor skill, you can get around certain interactions. The quests are usually pretty like ambiguous as far as like what's good and what's bad to do. That karma system is still there, so like you can be a good guy or a bad guy. The world is really big. There's a lot of locations to discover. I think the first Fallout game took me something around like 20 hours to beat, maybe a little less than that. And I was kind of like running through it pretty quick. I did two things. One, I did look up information online to see like, you know, how do I do certain things? Because some of the quests are pretty laid back as far as what kind of guidance they give you. They don't necessarily give you a check mark like the newer Bethesda games do, where like, okay, here's a quest, go do this, and then there's like a little thing that tells you exactly where to go. Mm-hmm. That doesn't exist here. It says find a water chip and you have like all of California and Nevada to search.
Wow.
And if you take too long, then Vault 13 dies of dehydration.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Did that really happen?
I mean, it does if you don't get that water chip.
Just not understanding what we're doing today.
So, the other thing I did to make it a little easier on myself was I did kind of edit some of my stats to be good.
Yeah.
Because this game is pretty hard. I mentioned the combat's all turn-based. You have, like, agility affects your AP, which, you know, AP is, like, the currency you advanced use placement. With VATS.
Yeah. I took AP US history.
Yep.
Did you take any AP?
Nope.
It sucked. Don't do it.
Yeah, I didn't need to.
In case you were thinking about going back and get your GED.
Nah, I already have my high school diploma.
Oh, okay.
I mean,
is that true?
Yeah, I have it. It's here somewhere.
Well, do you know where your college degree is?
Yeah.
I have no idea where mine is.
It's in there.
Yeah, I think mine was at my parents' house, but then they moved.
I have my high school diploma, my master's degree, and my undergraduate degree in there.
Wow.
Yeah. I got all three.
You like to look at them? Spread them out on a table?
Actually, I haven't looked at them in years.
You know what would be good to get like a bulletin board and put all of them up and put red string going from one to the other? At first glance, everyone thinks you've like cracked a case, and then they look at it and go, what the hell is that?
Crack the case.
Yeah, it's my trajectory. That's how they did it. They started, whoever's these are, it's yours. Yeah. Whoever's these are, they started at this one.
They ended up here.
Yeah.
At the end of
fact. And then there's a piece of paper with a question mark drawn on it. And that's the final red string.
Where does it go?
Where is she now?
That's my PhD.
Yeah.
And at the end, it was all worthless. So combat's all turn-based. You have AP. Essentially, you have like a form of VATS with this, but you don't have to use it. There's two fire modes with every gun and every weapon, where like one is you just hit. You just like do the function. And your percentage for like your skill and everything's taken into account, and whether or not you miss, how much damage you do, that sort of thing. And then there is like the VATS mode, where you can choose like what body part to hit with your particular weapon, and it has like different percentages on your accuracy and what you're likely to hit. One of my favorite parts about this mode was it typically did a little bit more damage. It took a little bit more AP, but there's an option within it where you can aim for their eyes specifically. And I'm like, that's cool. Like in Fallout 3 and Fallout 4 and New Vegas, you can aim for the head, mm-hmm. which is still an option in Fallout 1 and 2. But the eyes is its own category, which is great. So like
shoot people's eyes out?
Yes.
And that doesn't kill them?
It blinds them.
And then you just walk past them?
No, and then you just kill them because they can't see. Because like they can't hit you anymore.
Oh, cool. Did you see the new Paper Mario coming out?
I mean, this game was rated M, isn't it?
Yeah.
But
that's what I was thinking about, like turn-based combat. Oh, like Pokemon?
Yeah. So like I shot some Rad Scorpions in the eyes. I shot some Deathclaws in the eyes.
That is cool, actually.
It's nuts. It's bonkers. But it is harder. It's significantly harder.
Shooting their bonkers?
Yeah. The combat in Fallout 1 and 2 is significantly more difficult than Fallout 3 and onward, I think, because I think these newer games are a little bit more forgiving. They save more frequently. You get more resources. You typically have a better advantage in combat. Even turning the difficulty on easy in Fallout 1 and 2, I was struggling.
Yeah.
So I may have edited my stats just a little bit to give myself an edge.
Indestructible eyes, first off. That's the first thing.
Yeah, that's the first thing I did was
cyber eyes.
Bulletproof eyes. And then after that, I did bulletproof everything else. So, which was actually kind of a problem because, you know, there's way more than bullets in the wasteland.
Yeah.
Those death claws hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Between Fallout 1 and 2, both games are really fun and interesting, very familiar, a little bit more difficult. And definitely, like, if you're into retro games, like, at this point, absolutely. Like, these are fantastic to play. One of the things I loved about Fallout 2 in particular, well, Fallout 1 and 2 both have like special encounters. Like, you have like random encounters on the world map, and that's how you like come across different gangs of raiders and Rad Scorpions, Deathclaws in the wasteland on your way to your destination. Some of these special encounters are really silly, though. On one of them, my luck was high. So I found a friggin' spaceship and a little alien blaster pistol with it.
I have heard about that, actually.
Yeah, like Mothership Zeta in Fallout 3. Yep, that's where that came from.
That's cool.
So I found the spaceship. I also found the TARDIS from Doctor Who.
I've heard about that as well.
And it faded into another time or something. Like,
that is so fucked up. The Doctor didn't even try to help.
I know, right? We needed a water chip. And
oh, wibbly wobbly.
I didn't even know which Doctor it was. He didn't come out of his TARDIS at all.
If he didn't help, I'm going to guess Eccleston.
Okay, yeah, Ninth Doctor, let's go.
Oh, no. He's like,
no thanks. What you got going on, fantastic, though.
He said, fuck Russell T. Davies and got back in. Only the Who heads are going to get that joke.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, Russell T. Davies might be the one he likes. So
I don't remember.
Caleb, help me out here.
Caleb, please help.
Caleb.
It's like Caleb! Who wants to be a millionaire? Yeah. Lifeline, call a friend.
Call Caleb.
So
it's that meme, but it's me. I, you know, the video where the guy calls his dad to say he's going to win. You've seen that, right? It's like the final question, and he uses his lifeline. And his dad answers and he goes, "Hey dad, I'm calling. I don't actually need your help. I just wanted to let you know I'm about to win $1 million. And then he answers the question and gets it correct. It's like me doing that to Caleb. I'd be like, "Hey Caleb, I just wanted to let you know I'm about to lose everything." It is so fucked, dude.
I'm so scared right now.
I'm on to the first question.
And now the first question.
Yeah. Call Cub. Before the question's even out of their mouth.
Now the first question, what year is it?
Oh! Ask the audience.
So there's a little Twin Peaks reference there.
Oh, okay.
What year
I thought
is
it was also Doctor Who.
Oh, yeah. What year is it is the last word said at the end of The Return by Kyle MacLachlan.
I watched some of the new Doctor Who's.
I want to watch the new Doctor Who because it looks fun. It looks really
fun. Yeah, I watched the specials. I haven't watched like any of the proper...
Yeah, I kind of want to watch the new series when it comes out.
I think it's out now.
Is it?
Yeah, they're on Disney Plus now.
Oh, dang.
I got that Mickey money.
So Fallout 2 has more of these like silly encounters. Like, to the degree that... I found... what did I find in Fallout 2? There's like... There's a lot of really fun locations that you might stumble across. And Fallout 2 effect especially has like more silliness and like humor and its satire where it just flat out gets a little crazy. Fallout 1, you're like walking the wastelands, right? On foot. Fallout 2, you can get a car. You can like fix up a car and drive it around.
Oh, that's cool.
You'd need microfusion cells to like fuel it up. And it like it's significantly faster than walking around on the world map. There is one particular town in Fallout 2 where you can become a prize champion fighter and boxing. And right across the street, you can become a porn star. For real. I did both.
Yeah, could you do both?
Yeah, I did both. Like, why not?
Yeah.
You made 500 caps by making a porno.
Do people recognize you? Do people, does that have like an impact later in the game? People will be like,
no, but there is a particular area. There's a city called Broken Hills, which is mostly where super mutants live that are like friendly and intelligent. Mm-hmm. And there is a super mutant there that
super
you can,
mutant.
It's a super mutant.
It's Arnold Schwarzenegger. They should cast him as a super mutant in season two.
Maybe
a super mutant.
Yeah. So. In Broken Hills, there's a super mutant named Francis. You can challenge him to an arm wrestling match. And you make a wager. If you win, you get like some caps or something. If he wins, you're his sub for the night. And like the game like goes to a black screen if you lose. And then when you wake up the next morning, you have a ball gag in your inventory.
Was that the first time you ever looked up how to lose a game?
No. It was all random. It was a roll of the dice. What was I going to do?
Save scum until you lost.
But there are characters in another settlement on the other side of the wasteland that will be like, so yeah, Francis, huh? The entire settlement just is like, oh, so Francis, yeah? It's a pretty big dude, huh?
That's really funny.
Yeah, Fallout 2 is way sillier.
Yeah.
Far more silly. Than Fallout 1.
It sounds like.
Very much so.
Yeah.
It was also the first game, Fallout 2, I think in 1998, 1999, thereabouts. First game that I'm aware of where you could have a gay wedding.
Like ever? First?
Yeah, I think cool. So. I think it is.
That's cool.
So there's that too. Yeah. I did not do that, unfortunately. Either I did not come across them, I didn't bother looking it up.
Yeah.
And, like the characters that you can romance to like marry. I didn't know who they were.
Yeah.
I never saw dialogue that was like, so, you want to go on a date?
Right.
Sure. I saw a lot of dialogue that was like, you want to get some action?
Yeah. You want to hit it.
Cause there's also like, there's like the porn star thing. There's the thing with Francis. And then there's also just like prostitutes that you can like hook up with, throughout the wasteland.
Yeah.
I think that was also in Fallout 1. But there's an actual like perk or trait in Fallout 2 that is just sex appeal.
Yeah. Well, and I think wasn't that a thing in New Vegas? It's like totally broken. Like bisexuality is like one of the best.
Bisexuality gives you 10% of damage against all genders.
Yes.
Yes.
I remember doing that because it's like, yeah, sure.
Of course.
Like, yeah.
It's like the Joker. He's bisexual and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And stuff.
Fallout,
yeah.
That's what Fallout New Vegas. He's bisexual and stuff. New Vegas definitely took a lot of the stuff. And I think New Vegas was one of the games that I noticed like how much of this stuff was there and present. And of course, like, given Obsidian was mostly like a lot of Black Isle and Interplay devs that had since left those companies and formed their own company, it's kind of magical that Bethesda hired a studio comprised of people who made Fallout 1 and 2 to make another Fallout game, and that's New Vegas.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why New Vegas is so good, because, like, the people who know that the Fallout formula made it.
Yeah, right.
And that's why it's so horny. and everything else, too, and violent.
Yeah.
Fallout, horny and violent, all in one. I would absolutely recommend, if you like Fallout and you're willing to play a retro game, you want to get a little adventurous, play Fallout 1 and 2. They're really fun, and they last a little while, and they're really good RPGs. It's kind of like playing Disco Elysium, but in, like, 1999.
Right.
And you're in a nuclear post-apocalyptic wasteland.
Nice.
So, highly recommend. There's, like, a modding, like, community for these games, too.
Yeah.
There's mods. And,
can I ask you a general RPG question?
Yeah.
Do you feel like when you do run, if you're going into a game for the first time, mm-hmm. and you want to try to just experience it as pure as you can.
Yes.
So you're not looking up, like, how do I get X, Y, and Z? You're just playing it. Do you find you tend to kind of play the same type of character, or do you really make a decision to be like, I'm going to be very different? I'm going to, like...
I think it depends.
Like, I guess role play a little bit. For-
yeah, I think it depends on the game. There's a lot of games that, like, they're open world RPGs, and they, like, kind of incentivize, like, play stealthy and yeah. like Stealth Archer and Skyrim. Like,
right.
It's the most, like, simple and easy way to play the game and just absolutely wreck everything.
Yeah.
Sitting in a corner and, like, sniping a fucking dragon.
Yeah.
I do tend to, like, fall back into those tendencies quite often with games. I make an earnest effort to try different play styles mm-hmm. in games, especially ones that, like, really emphasize that you can. Like, games where, like, every weapon is viable. Like, Dark Souls is kind of like that, where you could essentially build each weapon to be something that you can beat the game with.
Yeah.
I do tend to, like, navigate towards a certain type of weapon in those types of games, or games with different play styles that they really want you to try different things with.
Sure.
Metal Gear, Metal Gear Solid 5 is great for that, because there's so much you can do.
Yeah.
But then, like, good or evil characters, sometimes I typically do play good, like, goody two shoes. And
me too. And I don't mind it, because, like, so I'm playing Baldur's Gate 3 right now.
Yes.
And I'm only, like, 3 hours in. Like, I'm still very
early.
I was taking a bit of a Helldivers break, and I did get back into Helldivers.
Talk to me when you're 100 hours into Baldur's.
Yeah, I know.
No, I'm just kidding.
But I'm already kind of thinking, like, I kind of want to do a second run and do full Dark Urge.
I want to
just be a monster. But then I'm like, do I just want to do that now? Because sometimes I think I get in my own head about it. And really, the correct answer is, as long as I'm having fun, who cares?
Yes.
But I feel like I always end up playing the same kind of archetype, which mm-hmm. is... I mean, it's a little bit of a self-insert. Like, I'm obviously... I don't think I would be good at any of this shit, but I like to... be talkative. I like to try to have, like, an okay charisma mm-hmm. in general. But then I do also like, and this is where it really departs from me completely, I like to have a high dexterity, because I find that in games like that. And that's basically how I'm playing this game.
Yeah.
But
you told me you were playing as a bard, which is precisely the class that I chose.
Yeah.
And
I still have quite a fear. I might reclass, but we'll see.
Every playthrough of Baldur's Gate 3 that I've done, I've played as a bard, and I've played, like, pretty good. And I really want to play Dark Urge, because that sounds really fun.
I want to be a dragon.
Yeah.
I want to be an evil dragon just going around.
I mean, my first playthrough, I was, like, a demon lady. Baldur's Gate 3 is one of those games, though, where it's like, I could do that now and then never play any other game ever again.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And I genuinely want to, like, play through it again with different play styles and different things like that. It's one of those games that I'm like, okay, I got to play this differently, because I keep seeing how different the game is.
Yeah.
Well, where other players have played it and they're experiencing things that I have played through multiple times, but I've never experienced this particular thing.
Yeah.
So some games you get, like, the option to be good or bad, and it just kind of, like, is a fork in the road that comes back into itself.
Yes.
And it doesn't really make a difference. And those games tend to just, like, default, but yeah. Like, in games that really do have a concerted effort to make the game different when you play different, I try.
Yeah.
It's not always, like, guaranteed, but I try. In Fallout 2, there's a scenario where Vault City It's a whole city made by people who have left their vault, and they're just outside of the door. Like, they still use the vault.
Yeah.
But they have a city outside now, thanks to the Gek that they had. And just a short, like, day trip away, there is a power plant that is still operational, but ghouls are operating it. And there's an issue with the plant where it's leaking radiation and it could potentially harm all the people in Vault City. So the natural response is, okay, we got to do something about the power plant that the ghouls are operating because it's killing us. Mm-hmm. And the leader of Vault City is the most, like, fucked up, awful person I've ever met in a video game. Like, she sucks.
Okay.
She absolutely sucks. And I was playing, like, a good character. So, I was like, no, you suck. I'm not gonna go kill the ghouls. I'm gonna help them fix the power plant.
Yeah.
And then, like, as a benefit of helping them fix the power plant, y'all are gonna get free energy.
Yeah.
Because they'll supply you too. And the end for that setting in the game, having repaired the power plant and optimized it to run at best capacity, and efficiency. The ending is that Vault City assaults the town of Gekko and the ghouls that are operating the power plant and takes it over for themselves. So they genocide them anyway.
And could you then get some revenge?
No, because that's the end of the game.
Oh, that
sucks. So it's Ron Perlman telling you that, like, okay, so Vault City totally fucked over Gekko, even though you worked so hard to, like, create a collaborating community between them.
Could you, like, knowing what you know, could you do a replay and kill Vault, like, the leaders of Vault City?
You could. I don't think that'll change the outcome, but not to the one that you think it is. I think that would be, like, Vault City was destroyed by the Vault Dweller or the Chosen One in Fallout 2. And if you don't optimize the power plant, but you repair it, then the ghoul genocide does not occur. And that's the only way to do it. But then, like, they're running at a lower efficiency. So, like, it's not the best ending, technically. And the other one's not the best either. They're not necessarily good or, like awful, evil, cartoonishly evil, necessarily. There's an ambiguity that kind of, like, makes you think for a bit before you make your decision. Like,
sure.
You know, who am I going to side with here? What am I going to do?
Yeah.
Because who knows what the outcome will be. But that said, these games are still silly, really fun.
Nice.
I highly recommend them.
Well, shall we move on?
Is it time for a heated gaming moment?
Let's do it.
Do you have one?
I do.
Okay. Do not yet.
Okay, I'll go first. This is something I've told you off, Mike. You gotta watch X-Men 97.
I do.
It's so good.
I really want to.
I am a little late to the party, but I'm current now. I think there's two more episodes at the time of this recording, and I am really enjoying it. I didn't follow the show much before it came out, so I had actually been watching the original 90s mm-hmm. cartoon. I was picking my way through it really slowly because I found that it sadly just hadn't aged that well to me. The animation doesn't look great, and as far as writing goes, it was just very Saturday morning cartoon.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. It just wasn't scratching any sort of itch for me. So I just decided to jump straight to 97 because I heard it was great. And I did not know that X-Men 97 is rated TV-14 until I was watching it. And you can first tell just because the writing in general just feels a little more grown up.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's, like, a little bit of blood. There's some mild language. And once that started happening, I was like, what is this rated? Because this is clearly not the same show I had just been watching mm-hmm. for a couple weeks.
You know what I heard about it?
Hmm.
I heard it's woke.
Yeah, you know, it's crazy that an X-Men show is woke. It's just insane. It's crazy. It's me. I was born yesterday.
I can't believe it.
And I can't believe that.
I can't believe a show about marginalized and oppressed peoples is, you know, about marginalized and oppressed peoples.
I am happy to see that most people just seem to love it and are celebrating it. And I'm glad for that because, like, it's really good. It's really, really great. And I think they actually did, like, Marvel did it right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also very curious where... Because it seems like the final episodes are setting up for this arc. Did you ever read any of the Ultimate Comics line? Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
Do you know of that, though? Like,
I'm aware.
Yeah, okay. So it was like in the... I think maybe it started technically late 90s, but it's a very like early 2000s to mid 2000s mm-hmm. era. It's very much like a perfect time capsule of when it was created. And the Ultimate Universe, one of the core conceits of it was that if characters died, they stayed dead.
No Lazarus pit here.
Exactly. Not like classic. So that's why, like, famously Peter Parker dies, and that's when Miles Morales kind of enters the equation. Mm-hmm. And Miles Morales was so popular, Marvel actually literally wrote him into the main universe. there's this event comic called Ultimatum that I actually read over Christmas because I had learned about it and people hate it. It's like one of the most reviled event comics in Marvel comics in general. And I it is bad. I had to read it for myself to see. But it's interesting because it was meant to be the end of the Ultimate comic universe. Mm-hmm. So like every other page, a hero is meeting a really grisly death. And that's why a lot of people didn't like it, because it is like, it's like some of the deaths are really gross and it's just for shock value. And they also literally have like no impact on the story. Mm-hmm. But I think X-Men 97 is pulling from that comic in terms of the story they're setting up. It's not going to be bad. Like I have enough faith in the show at this point. But I thought that was really interesting. Like what it is about is one day Magneto just has enough and he reverses Earth's magnetic polarities. So like Manhattan gets hit with a tidal wave and like all these natural disasters happen. All the electricity stops working for a time. And that's basically like the premise is that's it. And then the remaining heroes are like, we got to go get Magneto. And I think that's what this is setting up now in the show. But it's really good. It's really a big part of the show has actually been, I love the dynamic between Charles Xavier and Magneto, just mm-hmm. in like most things they're in. They have yet to share a scene in this show, but because Charles Xavier is off world, but a big premise of it is Charles Xavier, he's believed dead by the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And in his public last will, he said he wants Magneto to lead the X-Men. And so it's him clearly being like, I have not given up on my friend and he will see the way. So this season has been Magneto honestly trying to honor Charles, because that's my favorite thing about them, is even though they're at odds, they're villains, there's like a shared mutual respect. And for the friendship they had, Magneto was like, no, okay, I'll lead your team. And it's been him grappling with like trying to lead the X-Men, trying to see Charles's dream, but also being like, these people want us dead. Mm-hmm. And like, I could end this conflict. I could wipe out humans if I wanted. Like, I could literally destroy the world and do a genocide myself to save our people. But that's not what Charles would want. Pretty fucking cool.
It's been on my watch list, and I really want to sit down and watch it, because it sounds very good. I've heard a lot of great things about it. And X-Men kind of rule, so...
X-Men's really cool. I've been watching a lot of X-Men stuff this year. I really should read more of the comics. But it's a little overwhelming because there's so many X-Men comics.
There's a lot.
Yeah.
That's really my biggest deterrence from getting into comic books is like, okay, there's a backlog.
Yeah.
And the backlog is like 100 years.
You have to literally research like where to start. Like I could tell you Daredevil, obviously. Like yes. I could literally say you could start here with Daredevil and you'll be fine.
Because you're the Daredevil boy.
I'm the Daredevil guy. I'm the devil of Hex Kitchen.
Yeah.
But I like even like Spider-Man, like I couldn't tell you where to start with Spider-Man. I could give you specific books to read that I really like. But,
right.
And yeah. So... If anyone has a really good like X-Men,
Roman's looking
self-contained run, let me know.
Roman's looking for some good X-Men.
I'd love to read it.
Some good X-Men comics.
Yeah.
So is that the end of your
yes
moment? Well, here's my moment, and I think you'll appreciate this. We talked about this off mic as well, and that is, I started watching The Righteous Gemstones, mm-hmm. and I'm on season 3 and partway through.
You are past me, I think. I think we've seen the first 2 seasons.
Well, I'm on season 3 partway through. It's pretty good.
It's really good.
It's very funny.
It's hilarious.
Danny McBride is, I wouldn't go as far as saying he plays the same character and everything, but he's really good at playing an asshole.
Yeah, no, I love Danny McBride. I actually think Danny McBride is very talented, both as a performer and a writer.
Yes, I agree.
And yeah, no, he has a type for sure.
Oh, yeah.
There's a Danny McBride type, but
I was thinking I have watched Eastbound and Down. I've watched Vice Principals. It's been a while, so I might want to rewatch it.
Vice Principals also so good.
Incredible. I can't believe it was only 2 seasons.
I know, but I appreciate that they chose to end it.
Yes. And with each of those shows, Danny McBride stars and plays a huge asshole,
yes.
like in each one of them. And that's like the most defining thread between each of them is like he has like a mannerisms and a cadence to his speech and his like asshole-ish ways and like things that like he writes that are obviously like his kind of staple.
Right.
So like there will be similar things and familiarities between these characters, but like they're still decently different.
Yes.
And that is the thing that I do like The Righteous Gemstones, Vice Principals, Eastbound and Down. They're all comic and funny shows, but like they take place in such vast different settings with vast different characters of people that each one of them like stands very well on its own legs.
Yes. And it feels like they do all have something they're trying to say.
Yes. Yeah. I did like
Righteous Gemstones, especially. It's pretty clear. You look at literally the poster of Righteous Gemstones. You're like, I know exactly what that show is doing.
Precisely.
And it does it so well.
Precisely. And even then, like the writing is still very good. Like it doesn't necessarily like portray too many people as like two-dimensional. There's a little bit of three-dimensional in a lot of the characters, and there's a lot of like really nice moments, really like fucked up crazy moments, and then hilarious moments.
Yes.
Specifically, one of my favorite characters in the Righteous Gemstone is Uncle Baby Billy Freeman, played by none other than Walton Goggins, another staple of these like Danny McBride shows. He played one of the other main characters and vice principals, mm-hmm. As well as the ghoul in Fallout.
Yeah, Walton, he's the best.
But Walton Goggins is Uncle Baby Billy Freeman is like one of my favorite characters in the show. He's so very funny.
He's so funny.
He's so funny. And just like the cadence of the way he speaks and like the words he like the lines of dialogue that were written for Uncle Baby Billy are hilarious.
Yes.
The show is fantastically funny. And I've been enjoying it very much. It's really hard to like, I start watching an episode, I immediately want to watch another one.
Oh, yeah.
There's a bit of a, like a crime thriller aspect to it with the Righteous Gemstones, which is really fun.
Yeah. And I mean, the whole cast is great.
Yes.
Like we could talk about it for a long time, but I mean, John Goodman.
John Goodman's fantastic.
Yeah, like John Goodman.
John Goodman is so good in this show.
He's awesome. He's so good.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
He's great in general.
Yes. His approach to every scene is really excellent. John Goodman's character is one that, like, Eli Gemstone, I could kind of get lost in the disbelief of, like, okay, yeah, this is a real person. This is, like, genuine. And John Goodman sells it so flawlessly.
Yes.
Like, Danny McBride, you know, is Danny McBride. And, as Adam Devine, it's a workaholics guy.
Also very
guy.
Funny, but yes, he's playing a type too. Like, they're all perfectly casted.
Yes.
Who's the woman who plays Judy Gemstone?
I don't remember her name.
She's so fucking
funny.
She's
very funny.
I've been watching the Knuckles show a little bit, and she showed up in an episode. And Knuckles is, the other main character is Adam Pauly's character from the movies, who's like the doofus cop guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's so funny in it. And she plays his sister. And Knuckles and him are at their house, and they're having Shabbat dinner. And their mom is Stalker Channing from Grease. And I'm just like, I love that they're in the Knuckles show. And so basically it's just Adam Pauly and the woman who plays Judy Gemstone screaming at each other. And then they occasionally cut to Idris Elba as Knuckles.
That's another show I need to watch.
Yeah, it's fun. I'm like very slowly working my way through it.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like appointment viewing, you know, but mm-hmm. I like it enough.
Yeah, I really want to see that too because it sounds silly.
Yeah.
But I'd recommend if you like, you know, comedies with a little bit of crime, a little bit of assholes. Righteous Gemstones is the perfect little show for
it's
that.
No, it's really
it's good. Very fun. Well, I think we can wrap it up.
Yeah, let's call it. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next time.